Well, hello there, and welcome back to the Archaeology News Weekly. I am, as ever, your host, David Connolly. This news is brought to you in partnership between Stone Pages and the British Archaeological Jobs and Resources website. All the stories have been collected from various sources, and to view details on each story, including the source, please see the Stone Pages website at news.stonepages.com. And now, without further ado, the main headlines from around the world are as follows. Well, we'll start with this news of an Iron Age settlement unearthed in Kent, then to over 1,000 new sites discovered off the British coast in a major new project. The intriguing case of the skeleton of a Western man found in ancient Mongolian tomb is investigated, and back to the UK with a prehistoric archaeological project in Dorset getting lottery grant funding. The last Neanderthals in Europe died out 37,000 years ago, according to a new study. And, cutting to the bone, we report on amputation, which provides evidence of medical knowledge in the Neolithic. The fifth megalomania, or is it megalithmania, conference is there, shall we say, dealt with. And finally, on a gentle note, evening walks at Stonehenge in June. The remains of an Iron Age settlement have been unearthed by archaeologists working along the route of a new 1.3 million water pipeline in Kent in England. Tim Allen from Kent Archaeological Project said that they had found evidence of post holes, pits and ditches, possibly part of an Iron Age dwelling, along with pieces of pottery that can be dated to the late Iron Age. It's likely that the Iron Age remains are associated with a prehistoric roundhouse that would have been approximately 8 metres in diameter, with timber supports and walls and roof made with wattle and daub. Paul Clifford, engineering manager at South East Water, said that on large schemes such as this, they take extra precautions of having archaeologists working alongside the contractors to ensure that if they do find anything of significance, they can halt the work for further investigations. That ensures that they can continue to protect and record ancient heritage. Well, good on you there, South East Water. Nearly 1,000 new archaeological sites have been discovered off the northeast British coast as part of an English Heritage-funded project. The survey was conducted by English Heritage archaeologists along with the help from Northumberland Coast Area of Outstanding Natural Beauty, and it's been done to help researchers understand the history of the coastline and the damages that it may face in the future. Uncovered during the project were a number of Iron Age multivalent forts and hill forts. David MacLeod, senior investigator with English Heritage's aerial survey team, said that often it's only by looking at a site from the air that you start to understand its size and structure. Historic sites along the coast are vulnerable to the effects of both natural coastal change and human activities, although erosion has actually helped to reveal a number of nationally important sites along the northeast coast, such as Bronze Age burial mounds at Low Hawksley in Northumberland. They often, I'm afraid, also pose a threat. This project will help us to understand not just the history of the coastline, but also the dangers it faces now and in the future. Dr. Clive Waddington from Archaeological Research Services, who carried out the survey, said that they had always known the northeast coastline was rich in archaeological sites. However, they were surprised not just at the number of new sites that they found, but also by the range and diversity. This survey has provided evidence for human activity in the region from prehistoric times right through to the modern day and helped build a much better picture of what activities were taking place along the coast over the last 10,000 years. By 2010, the survey aims to have produced the most detailed picture yet of the threat posed to the nation's heritage by rising sea levels, coastal erosion and managed realignment of the coast. The results will allow decisions to be made about the best way to manage the coastline to preserve historical sites or, where nothing can be done, to ensure that they're recorded and understood before erosion takes its toll. As part of the project, Dr. Waddington's team is now working with experts from Durham University to feed the results into a computer-generated map. This can then be used as a predictive tool, for example, to identify which sites could be under threat if there was a rise in sea level. For more information about this, the Rapid Coastal Zone Assessment Survey, pop along to the English Heritage website, english-heritage.org.uk. You can search for the story there. There's actually also a large number of reports of other coastal surveys done around the coast of England. DNA extracted from a man whose skeleton lay in one of the more than 200 tombs recently excavated at a 2,000-year-old cemetery in Western Mongolia puts him as a descendant of Europeans, or at least Western Asians. Yet he still assumed a prominent position in the ancient Mongolia's Xiongnu Empire, so say geneticists from Chung-An University in South Korea. On the basis of previous excavations and also descriptions in ancient Chinese texts, researchers suspect that the Xiongnu Empire, which ruled a vast territory from 209 BCE to 93 CE, included ethnically and linguistically diverse nomadic tribes. The empire once ruled the major trading route known as the Asian Silk Road, opening it to both Western and Chinese influences. Researchers have yet to find the language spoken by Xiongnu rulers and political elites, but the new genetic evidence shows that the 2,000-year-old man was multi-ethnic, just like the Xiongnu Empire itself. The Dorlignar's man's genetic signature supports the idea that Indo-European migrations to northeastern Asia started before 2,000 years ago. The notion is plausible but not confirmed, says geneticist Peter Underhill of Stanford University. Further investigations of Y chromosome mutation frequencies in modern populations will allow for a more precise tracing of the Dorlignar man's geographic roots. Scholars have indeed long fought and sought to trace the origin and spread of related languages now found in Europe, India and other parts of Asia. One hypothesis holds that Indo-European languages proliferated via several waves of expansion and conquest by nomads known as the Kurgans, who had domesticated the horse and were thus able to travel longer distances. In this scenario, Kurgans left the homeland north of the Black Sea in what was now Russia around 6,400 years ago. Another view holds that farmers from ancient Turkey spread Indo-European tongues as they swallowed up one parcel of land after another, beginning around 9,000 years ago. But since 1978, discoveries of 2,400 to 4,000-year-old mummified corpses with European features in northwestern China, not far from Mongolia, have fueled the Kurgan hypothesis. Add to those discoveries a report by geneticist Christine Kaiser of the University of Strasbourg in France and her colleagues who found that 9 of 26 skeletons previously excavated at 11 Kurgan sites in northeastern Russia possessed a Y chromosome mutation pattern thought to mark the eastward expansion of early Indo-Europeans. That same genetic signature characterizes the Dorlignar man. Kim's group plans to extract and study DNA from additional Dorlignar skeletons. This new study from Mongolia is important because it adds one more point of light to a largely dark prehistoric sky. What a poetic way to end a fascinating story. An archaeological scheme to investigate an area of Blandford in Dorset in England, where ancient settlements have been found, has been given a £23,000 lottery cash boost. In 2008, a dig was carried out on the site earmarked for the new Milldown primary school in the town. It found evidence that the site was lived in between the end of the Stone Age and the beginning of the Bronze Age, so between 5,000 to 4,000 years ago. During the excavation, a large number of flint tools and indications of pits and ditches were discovered. The money will pay for further research into the signs of the settlement. I like the proper cost they gave me, which was actually £23,100. Well, I suspect that £100 is going to be going on tea and biscuits. A new paper by Professor Zilhau and colleagues builds on earlier research that proposed that south of the Cantabro-Pyrenean mountain chain in Spain, Neanderthals survived for several millennia after being replaced or assimilated by anatomically modern humans everywhere else in Europe. Although the reality of this Ebro frontier pattern has gained wide acceptance since it was first proposed by him some 20 years ago, two important aspects of the model have remained the object of unresolved controversy: the exact duration of the frontier and the causes underlying the eventual disappearance of this refuge Neanderthal population. Professor Zilhau and colleagues now report new dating evidence for the late origination of Portugal, an archaeological culture unquestionably associated with modern humans, that firmly constrains the age of the last Neanderthals of southern and western Iberia to no younger than some 37,000 years ago. This new evidence therefore puts a limit of 5 millennia onto the duration of the Iberian Neanderthal refuge period and counters speculations that Neanderthal populations could have remained in the Gibraltar area until 28,000 years ago. These findings have important implications for the understanding of the archaic features found in the anatomy of a 30,000-year-old child unearthed at Lagar Velho in Portugal. With the last of the Iberian Neanderthals dating to many millennia before the child was born, freak crossbreeding between immediate ancestors drawn from distinct modern and Neanderthal gene pools cannot be a viable explanation. The skeleton's archaic features must therefore represent either evolutionary significant admixture at the time of contact, as suggested by the team who excavated and studied the fossil. The professor believes the Ebro frontier pattern was generated by both climatic and demographic factors, as it coincides with a period of globally milder climate, with which oak and pine woodlands expanded significantly along the west side of Iberia. Population decrease and breakup of interaction networks probably occurred as a result of the expansion of such tree-covered landscapes, favouring the creation of persistence of refuge populations. And then, as environments opened up again for large herbivore herds and their hunters as a result of the return to colder conditions, the interaction and movement across the previous boundary must have ensued. And the last of the Neanderthals underwent the same process of assimilation or replacement that underpinned their demise elsewhere in Europe 5 millennia earlier. Sounds like some sort of relentless horror story there. Watch out, Homo sapiens is out there. Scientists unearthed evidence of surgery carried out in ancient times during work on an early Neolithic tomb discovered at Boutherez-Boulancourt, 65 kilometres south of Paris. They found that a remarkable degree of medical knowledge had been used to remove the left forearm of an elderly man around 6,900 years ago. The patient seems to have been anaesthetised, the conditions were antiseptic, and the cut was clean and the wound was treated, according to the French National Institute for Preventative Archaeological Research. The revelation could force a reassessment of the history of surgery, especially because researchers have recently reported signs of two other Neolithic amputations in Germany and the Czech Republic. It was known that Stone Age doctors performed trepanations, which is cutting holes in the skull, but not amputations. The first European farmers were therefore capable of quite sophisticated surgical acts. The discovery followed research on the tomb of an elderly man who lived in the Linear Band Karamik period, when Europeans settled down to agriculture, stock breeding and making pottery. The patient was obviously important because his grave was 2 metres long, bigger than most, and contained a schist axe, a flint pick and the remains of a young animal, which are evidence of high status. The most intriguing aspect, however, was the absence of the forearm and hand bones. A battery of biological, radiological and other tests showed that the humerus bone had been cut in an intentional and successful amputation. A flint was almost certainly used as a scalpel, and pain-killing plants were likely to have been used as well, perhaps a hallucinogenic datura. Other plants, like sage, would have been used to clean the wound, and macroscopic examination has revealed no signs of infection, suggesting that it was conducted in relatively antiseptic conditions. The patient survived for the operation, and although he suffered from osteoarthritis, he lived for months, perhaps years afterwards. A bit like hospital operations now. Right, well, my favourite one here, the Megalithomania Conference, which is planned in Glastonbury in Somerset for the dates 8th to the 9th of May. Among the speakers, Aubrey Burrell will be giving a glimpse into his new research on stone circles, and Robert Bovall will be discussing his breakthrough discoveries about the origins of Egypt. And we also have Andrew Collins revealing the cave and tunnel system beneath Giza that he's recently discovered, leading to the Hall of Records. I think I might have to just Google that one. Staying on the continent, Michael Tellinger will be opening up a lost megalithic civilization from Great Zimbabwe that is arguably the oldest city-state on the planet. Didn't he write a book about slave species of the god? Well, we've also got Antoine Gigal, who's rediscovered pyramids on Mauritius, as well as on Sicily and Tenerife, that show an ancient unknown seafaring nation. Well, let's keep going. Francine Blake will be comparing ancient rock carvings to modern crop circles. Wait a minute. This is just nothing but archaeological pseudo-babble, is it not? I think one of the important things we have to do, and part of the reason I actually put this in, is people are quite entitled to hold these conferences and even hold these views. But I'd like you to remember that the point of archaeology is not to go and find what you're looking for, but to look for what you find. Well, think about that one. As I said, we end on this rather shortened archaeology news with a nice gentle evening walk in Stonehenge. During June 2010, David Dawson, director of the Wiltshire Archaeological and Natural History Society, will lead a series of one-hour-long tours within the stones of Stonehenge themselves, providing an opportunity to see the main features of the circle and learn about the cycle of its construction and rebuilding. It will be allowed, you'll be allowed to inspect and photograph for non-commercial purposes, of course, the stones closely and see the inscriptions, including the famous daggers believed to date from prehistoric times themselves, and wander at will inside the circle. There'll be three visits, the first two afford an opportunity to observe the evening sunset from within the circle itself. That's on the 10th of June and 14th of June, starting at 8:45. The third evening is slightly earlier, on the 9th of July, and that's at 7:30pm. You'll be meeting at the Stonehenge car park 5 minutes before the booked time. Last year's event actually was so popular, prior booking is absolutely essential. The cost, yes, there's a cost, of course, is £18, and £11 for children, but wow, that's going to be worth it. You actually get reduced rates if you're a National Trust or English Heritage member. You can contact the booking secretary on 01380 727 369 or send them an email at wanhs@wiltshireheritage.org.uk. Well, I'll just round off this edition with the news about the Voices of the Past website. Absolutely brilliant website, and I'll confess, run by friends of ours as well, but really pushing the bounds of web technology. They've got netcasting and podcasting accompanying the website and is hoping to inspire advancement of heritage values in the society and use today's online communications to create social media within heritage. You'll find that, this brilliant website, Voices of the Past, at www.voicesofthepast.org. And while I'm at it, why not plug Past Horizons, one of the best sites out there to get involved in archaeology, www.pasthorizons.com. And as I said, we'll be bringing out the magazine within the next 2 weeks, so watch out for issue 11. Can I also remind people that Badger is getting bigger and better? We have a new forum, the Badger Fed, so you'll find that at www.badgerfed.co.uk. There's news, views, conference announcements, and of course, the forum where you can ask and quite often get a reasonably sensible answer. If you want a properly sensible answer, then why don't you have a look at Stone Pages? There's lots to be found there about the megalithic past. Go to Stone Pages and read the news as well, news.stonepages.com. Thank you for listening to, again, Archaeology News Weekly. We hope you'll return again to us next week.